Local and national incidents of sexual assault on college campuses have gotten people talking about the prevalence of this problem and the role universities ought to play in dealing with it.
We don't have a formal legal process here, and that is not what we're supposed to have. And that makes our role in this, I think, confusing and hard to communicate sometimes.
Those are the words of KU Chancellor Bernadette Gray Little. The distinction between a legal response to allegations of sexual assault and a school's course of disciplinary action really can be a source of confusion for everyone involved. On today's Central Standard, we'll hear from students, school officials, and others to help sort it all out. Stay with us. Yesterday, our intern Matt Hodapp went to UMKC to ask students whether conversations about sexual assault are happening here on campus.
Not really. I mean, for the most part, I'd say no. I mean, maybe every once in a while, yeah, but generally no.
What do you hear when people bring it up?
We just talk about usually how awful it is as a general issue around college campuses.
Here on this campus, I've heard of fraternities kind of talking about jokes about it, or like sororities would talk about how they would joke about it, which I don't think is okay. But overall, I think it's a pretty progressive campus, but I mean, there's obviously a lot of work that could be done.
The work to be done to untangle problems relating to sexual assault on college campuses is a national conversation. California just passed a law establishing yes means yes as a standard for consent. President Obama just issued an It's On Us message to the nation, calling sexual assault on campus, quote, an affront to our basic humanity. But what is a school's responsibility to students and their families when sexual assault occurs on campus? Where does school policy end and legal action begin? I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll find out how local universities are handling these questions. A high-profile case has shaken the KU campus in Lawrence, and we'll get deeper into that in a minute. But first, a broad local overview from KCUR's Laura Ziegler, who's been reporting on these issues. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Gina.
Thanks for being here.
You bet.
In May, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Issues Civil Rights issued a list of 55 colleges and universities under investigation for Title IX violations concerning the possible mishandling of sexual violence and harassment complaints, a list that has grown to include more than 70 schools since then. A handful of Kansas and Missouri schools are on that list. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's important to say that these are schools whose complaints are being investigated and they're alleged violations. I think that's important to establish at the outset. But they do include University of Kansas, the University of Missouri, K-State, and Washburn University in Topeka.
Really respected institutions.
Very much so.
What is going on? Tell us about what's going on at K-State and Washburn. What do we know about the efforts on these campuses and the school's handling of the cases when they arise?
Well, at Washburn, I talked to the director of Equal Opportunity there, and she was quick to say that there was one complaint filed, but one complaint filed is enough to get you on the list for being a school under investigation. And they are launching a huge public relations effort to put out information and brochures and seminars and talk about the differences between law enforcement in the community and law enforcement on campuses. But again, they have the one complaint that's been filed for their Title IX office. I wasn't able to talk to anybody at K-State, but they have broadened the role of their Women's Center to reflect the university's expanded efforts to combat campus violence. I got from their website the name change from the Women's Center to the Office to Combat Campus Violence says that they are brought – the intent is to broaden the purpose, specifically expanded to extend to bystander intervention and educational campaigns, while at the same time honoring the purpose and mission of the Women's Center. So what they're doing is just looking beyond the women's community to look more deeply into these allegations.
Here in Missouri, Senator Claire McCaskill has conducted a survey of 440 campuses. What are the findings of that survey?
Well, I think the most important finding is that they were shocked and stunned, in the words of people in their office, the staffers that have been working on it, to find out how many institutions were not dealing with this problem seriously.
What does it mean to not deal seriously with the problem? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, it means that some of them didn't have Title IX coordinators, which is Title IX, of course, is the federal law that where complaints are made to investigate sexual assault and sexual violence of a number of varieties. A number of them didn't have policies in place. A number of them didn't have adjudication, didn't have prevention training, didn't have counseling services and mental health services, et cetera.
Wow. Well, Laura, the curators of the University of Missouri are here at UMKC this week to talk about the university president's proposed new rules surrounding this. What are the proposed new rules?
Well, the University of Missouri president earlier this year issued a set of executive orders in response to a suicide of a woman who was alleged to have allegedly sexually assaulted an athlete several years ago on campus. And that set in motion, in the context, again, of this national conversation about sexual assault, a series of investigations and conversations on campus. And President Tim Wolf issued an executive order that they were going to be strengthening their reporting requirements. And just a couple of weeks ago, he strengthened those requirements. And this is what the curators are going to be voting on this week, to say that anybody that heard about a sexual assault or any type of sexual violence on campus would have to report it immediately to authorities.
Are people expressing any concerns about those rules that you know of?
Some of the student advocates and people in different offices are concerned that it will have a chilling effect on what they hear from people, because some of the advocates who deal with some of these people, you know, to back up for a second, I think it's 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 of the alleged cases of sexual violence go unreported because people are so worried about being blamed as a victim. And at the same time, we know from FBI statistics and Department of Education statistics that the incidence of these crimes are very high on college campuses. So, students that work, student groups and mental health organizations that work with some of these students like to give people options, the assumption being not everybody might want to go forward and prosecute.
Right, the option of speaking confidentially.
Yeah, and maybe deciding not to go forward with some kind of legal action. So there are some people are worried that if it's a requirement by university law that anybody that hears about any of these cases has to report immediately to authorities, people aren't going to want to come forward.
What do you think is the thought behind asking people to do that?
I think the university wants to be more accountable. You know, they want to make sure that they are showing the community, the university community, and the public that they're taking these allegations seriously.
Right, and that people aren't just going to stand by and know something's amiss and not report it.
What it does, Gina, is it just suggests what a complicated set of problems this is.
Well, let's shift gears to talk about KU. That school has received a lot of really unfavorable national press for how it reportedly handled a sexual assault incident that took place in October of 2013. It's a complicated series of events with new developments unfolding all the time. Could you give us just the most very basic timeline?
About the KU situation?
Yeah.
Well, I think that what we need to understand about KU is that it's been sort of in the spotlight by some of the national press, maybe more so than some of the other schools. Although they've been looking at schools all around the country, KU has received its fair share of the national spotlight. Over the last couple of years, activism on campus, activism has accelerated as the perception spread that the university was too lenient on perpetrators of sexual assault. For example, they were giving them punishments such as writing an essay. You
know. Can we just back up, though, and get sort of what basically has happened in case people haven't really heard those reports?
This week there was an allegation that Kappa Sigma fraternity was alleged to have had some incidents of sexual assault in their fraternity over the weekend, and they were reported to the Lawrence police. So the chancellor swiftly took action and suspended on an interim basis activities of the Kappa Sigma fraternity at KU. And that's pending investigation. So all
right. And let's get over now to Emma Halling. She's a KU student who recently vocally expressed concerns about the university's handling of a case that actually occurred in October 2013. Emma's the former student body president and co-chair of the Title IX committee at KU. We'll hear from KU's Title IX coordinator for the school's position in a moment. But first, Emma, can you tell us, to the best of your knowledge, what happened?
In this particular case?
Yeah.
So the victim went to a party with a perpetrator. She was way too intoxicated to consent. They went back to her university housing, and the perpetrator had sex with her, and she repeatedly said, no, stop, I can't do this. He continued anyways. The next morning, she was really fuzzy about what happened because she had been so intoxicated. Then she started to realize that she texted him and asked what had happened. And he was like, oh, yeah, you were so drunk, but sex occurred. He admitted it. And then she reported it both to the police and to the Office of Institutional Opportunity and Access. And investigations went forward. It's really unusual for a perpetrator to actually admit to raping someone and knowing that they couldn't consent, but he did that. And throughout the process, there were no criminal charges filed against him. And the university recommendations ended up being probation, I think. The paper is actually a miscommunication. The victim's lawyer has issued a statement saying that he wasn't even required to write a 4-page paper, so it was literally just probation.
Okay, and Jane McQueenie, Title IX coordinator for KU, is that also your understanding of the course of events?
Well, Gina, you know, as the Title IX coordinator and the person responsible for investigations, we cannot comment about a specific case that's been under investigation. And we do that out of respect for the victim and her privacy. I want to say that not everything in the press is the full details of the case in our investigation. And if I was reading just the media account, I perhaps would be angry too. I would like to also say that it's part of our process to always consider the victim's input in terms of what our recommendations are for sanctions in a case like this.
Emma, how did you come to the forefront of this conversation?
So last year there was an incident on campus where Al Jazeera America ran a story about our party culture. They could have picked any university in the nation, but they picked Kansas because we're in the heartland and we look representative. And a lot of the students on the video were saying really problematic things about intoxication, consent. I wake up in the morning and I don't know if we had sex last night or not. And that's
that
really
kind
problematic.
Of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. In response to that, I helped to bring students into the conversation about sexual assault and consent by putting students on the Title IX roundtable. And then we worked through the roundtable last year. I had a number of victims come forward to me and talk about cases where they had reported or cases where they hadn't reported, and really concerned with how their complaints were being handled on campus. And so that spurred me to be more vocal in calling for better processes.
So what are your biggest objections in the case that's getting so much attention right now, the 2013 case that had a very recent ruling?
Our big problem is that it's a two-part process. So the Office of Institutional Opportunity and Access will do an investigation and they will make their recommendations. But from there, it's handed off to the Office of Student Affairs. And so even if the findings of the IOA is that the student is responsible and more likely than not did this, unless suspension or expulsion is on the table, then there is not a panel meeting. It is one representative from the Student Affairs office who has the discretion to say, I actually think that this happened or I don't. And so they can issue their sanctions accordingly, which is really problematic to have it be a one-person up-down situation.
Jane McQueenie, as Title IX coordinator for KU, where do you fit into the process?
Our process, or where we fit in, is to make sure that if we are on notice of a complaint or a concern related to sexual assault on campus, that we're reacting. And our first and foremost concern is the safety of the complainant on campus. So we're going to make sure were talking to that person about what's happened and putting in place things that guarantee their access or their continued access to education.
What kind of things?
Interim measures is what it's called. And so we're looking at tutoring, changing residence halls for the respondent if that's necessary, escorts on campus.
The respondent, is that the person who's been accused?
Yes, it is. Yes. Okay. So the complaint is a person that has been subjected to the behavior that's problematic, the sexual assault or the harassment, and the respondent is the person that's been accused of violating our policy.
Okay. And so you can do things like, where does tutoring fit into that?
So, for instance, if someone has undergone a trauma, if they've been subjected to a sexual assault, they may have some real difficulty getting to class. They may fall behind in their assignments. So we try to get them into the office as soon as possible so that we can put things in place that help them get back, start the healing process, and ensure their access to education.
Is your role related to a legal process, a psychological recovery process, an academic process, or some combination of those things?
Well, that's a really good question. So really, we're the Title IX coordinator, so we're the legal process. But part of the legal process includes guaranteeing access to education. And so our role is to ensure that we're putting in place things that guarantee that students are getting back to class, that they're participating in all the programs and activities that they would have normally before the incident.
What is the relationship between the legal process, which finds someone who's been accused of sexual assault guilty or innocent in the eyes of the law, and a school's investigation and response to a situation?
So we are determining whether there's been a violation of a policy, the university sexual harassment policy. So that's our role in making recommendations. So we determine if the policy's been violated, and then we make recommendations in terms of sanction that will stop and correct the behavior and prevent it from occurring in the future.
So in the case of KU's sexual harassment policy, what are the aspects of that policy that would pertain to sexual assault in particular and to the safety of a student?
So sexual assault is a form of sexual violence that's included in the general umbrella of sexual harassment. So we make a determination whether a hostile environment has been created on campus, and a hostile environment can be created by pervasive or severe acts. So a sexual assault is one severe act that can create a hostile environment on campus. So that's kind of the legal framework.
And then the Office of Institutional Opportunity and Access, what can that office do in these cases? Say someone has been determined to be in violation of the school's policy. What is within your power?
Our power, or what our role is to make a recommendation to the appropriate university official in terms of what we think the sanction should be in a particular case based on the facts in front of us.
Central Standard is going to take a quick break. Jane, Emma, Laura, please stay with us. We'll hear more about KU's handling of sexual assault reports when we return. We'll bring a national expert in on the conversation, and we'll take your questions. Call 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. You're listening to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we have a full house this morning as we discuss the pressing issue of sexual assault on college campuses. We've been hearing about the events on the campus of KU in Lawrence that have garnered national attention. We also want to hear from you. When you or someone you love heads to a residential college, what is your expectation of that school? Is it strictly educational? Or does the school fill a social and protective role as well? Where does the school's responsibility end and legal intervention begin? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. Let's return to KU's Title IX coordinator, Jane McQueenie, for now. Jane, according to an article published in August, a confidential KU survey of 900 undergraduate and graduate students found that 11% of students have been victims of sexual harassment, including sexual assault. It also found that only 2% had reported what happened to your office. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, two things. First of all, the 11% number is lower than what the national average and the DOJ, the Department of Justice studies have shown, 1 in 5, women during the course of their college careers will be sexually assaulted on campus. So that number is lower. The 2% is consistent with the underreporting that we see as one of the major barriers to being able to address this issue on our campuses.
To what do you attribute such a low reporting rate, though, just even nationwide?
I think that in the past there's been stigma associated with I think that the conversations are difficult to have. We're talking about intimate acts. In our work, we've seen that victims, survivors oftentimes take some blame on themselves and wonder what they did to cause a situation, which makes it very difficult to come forward.
Something that really struck me reading up on the current scandal and listening to Emma speak about it is that the student who reported that she had been assaulted seemed to be shuffled around quite a bit from one office to another. And it sounds like there are different reviewing bodies who look at these cases at different stages in the process, which is a little bit confusing. What are these different offices and how coordinated are their efforts?
Well, I think to say she's shuffled around, it was the process is a streamlined approach. So she comes to our office, and that is a very consistent one-stop shop. And then it's after we've completed our investigation that it goes to another university office. We work very closely with our campus partners. It is a concerted effort to try to put in place the efforts the things that will keep that victim feeling safe on campus. We work with many. Our Emily Taylor Center for Women and Gender Equity is a key partner in working with our students.
You know, something else that's come under scrutiny is the university's use of some what sounds a little like peculiar language to describe what's happened, this phrase non-consensual sex. Some students have objected and said that this is like calling theft non-consensual donation. Can you explain that terminology?
Sure. The term non-consensual sex is really primarily driven by the fact that we're looking at a civil process, a university process. And so we're using a completely different standard of proof, a preponderance of the evidence, where the term rape really is a criminal term that derives from a criminal statute. We are not making those kinds of determinations, which uses a different burden of proof, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. So the term non-consensual sex is a term that's used across this country in many university policies.
Something that's, I think, confusing to a lot of people who are reading about this, and you've mentioned that to the best of your knowledge, not everything is being shared in the media reports, but that the young man who's been accused hasn't denied the accuser's story. And I think most people can understand that assigning guilt is tricky in a context of innocent until proven guilty. But when someone's not denying anything, what's stopping a university from taking the strictest measures imaginable, expelling someone?
Well, so I think that it's important to recognize, I can't comment about the specific case, but our policy allows us to make a determination without the respondent ever being interviewed. So sometimes we're making recommendations based on facts that are very complex in terms of people's ability to remember, the reliability. Oftentimes with students, there may be alcohol involved, which makes it difficult for the witnesses to even be credible on some of the facts. So when we say there has been an admission, sometimes I think that's a misnomer. I don't know that the evidence is really quite as clear as that.
Emma, as a student at KU, how do you feel hearing this assessment?
I understand that the disconnect is often between the obligations of an institution and the student perception. So the offices at the University of Kansas have an obligation to protect the university and to make sure that it is run according to the rules and regulations that dictate its behavior under federal and state law. But students' experiences of those regulations can often be negative experiences. They can struggle to understand the processes. So even if a process is fully compliant with all federal and state regulations, that doesn't necessarily mean that a victim who has just been through an extraordinarily traumatic event will understand what's happening, will not be confused, and won't feel even more persecuted by the process.
Let's turn to Lara Kaufman. She's a national expert in these issues with us by Skype from Education Policy for At-Risk Students, where she serves as director and senior counsel. Hi, Lara.
Hi.
Do issues coming up in the story you're hearing play out in some way at most schools across the country, or are some of these issues particular to KU?
This is happening all over the country, and it's been in the eye of the national media for quite some time. There are a number of students who've banded together into a group called Know Your Nine, and they've been advocating for their rights. They've been filing complaints against their universities and getting a lot of attention. And the Department of Education has done a lot of guidance on this issue, and the president started an initiative on this back in January. So it's clearly a widespread problem.
Is the initiative part of what's sparking greater recognition that of the degree of the problem, or is there something else to account for the fact that this is really bubbling up to the surface in public discussion right now?
I think it's a combination of two things. One is the student activism, because the stories started coming out, and the stories are so compelling and heartbreaking and shocking sometimes at what schools have done or not done. And so it's a combination of those powerful stories that then got the attention at the highest levels of government, and therefore the attention, of course, from the president is a huge development that has really forced schools to take a close look at what they're doing.
This issue that has come up a little bit about the difference between preponderance of evidence, which is the standard that schools typically use in these cases, and guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that that's in legal contexts, in the legal and judicial system. Can you talk a little bit about that? Explain those two things?
Yes. In a criminal court, our system requires that someone be proven guilty by beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a very, very high standard of proof to meet, and it makes sense that we use that standard because someone's liberty is at risk. The sanctions for violating the law are very high. Usually, in this case, it would be prison. In the school context, we're talking about a disciplinary hearing. We're talking about really a civil dispute. The school has no power to imprison somebody. And the standard that the Office for Civil Rights at the Department of Education has told schools they must use is the preponderance of the evidence. That means they have to find that it's more likely than not that sexual assault occurred. And that's the right standard because that's the standard under Title IX in civil court. It's the standard that the Department of Education uses in its investigations, and it's a reasonable standard to use.
So there isn't concern with that about people who have not been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt being held up to disciplinary action in schools?
I think there are some folks who would have concerns about that, but it is not a concern on our part. We think it's a reasonable expectation of schools. And again, there's a huge difference between the criminal justice process and a school disciplinary hearing.
Are there counter incentives for universities when it comes to transparency in disciplinary action? A university's reputation is likely going to suffer as a result of prominent high-profile sexual assault incidents. So a school might arguably have an interest in finding grounds for dismissing cases. And I'm quite certain that there are lots and lots of people working hard in earnest to help students on campuses. But is there some validity in that systemic concern?
There is. I think there, for some time, has been a huge disincentive to even acknowledge that these sorts of things have happened on their campuses, much less to initiate disciplinary action and a sanction. I think schools don't want to admit that this is a problem. No one likes to think that their campus is hostile and unsafe for a large number of their students. But those incentives really need to be turned. And I think some of the reporting requirements that have been adopted are going to help change those disincentives, because schools are now going to have to be on top of these incidents. The investigations that are being conducted are holding schools accountable for ignoring what happens. So they're better off finding out about it and taking action than trying to sweep it under the rug.
California just this week has established yes means yes as its standard for consent, and established uniform expectations for how schools in that state that are receiving state funding respond to cases. Do you think, first of all, explain that, but then also tell us whether you think that's going to start a new trend nationwide beyond California?
Well, I think it's a very interesting development. What yes means yes is doing is setting the standard that instead of no means no, which for years has always been the expression that, that people have used in terms of sexual assault, we're shifting the burden. The burden is now on the perpetrator or the student who wants to initiate sexual intercourse or sexual activity to ensure that he or she is getting an affirmative yes from the person that they're participating with. Before, it was the victim's burden to say no, but at that point, especially when you're talking about intoxicated people, it's people weren't taking seriously that no really means no, and the burden shouldn't have to be on the victim. So it's shifting the burden. I think it's hopefully going to spark a trend because I think that's really important. I think we need to see a cultural shift and we need to get students talking about consent and what it means. And I might add that this needs to happen well before college. By the time students get to college, many of them are already sexually active. So we need to start engaging younger students in these conversations about what consent means and what healthy relationships look like.
Lara, you mentioned drinking and that intoxication is often a part of this. Can we talk about the issue of drinking on college campuses? Because I wonder if it's possible to effectively deal with one of these problems without dealing with the other.
I think we have two different issues. I don't think that we can blame alcohol for the conduct, for our actions and our conduct. I think sometimes what alcohol does is lower people's inhibitions and can confuse situations. But I think there is a problem with students overdoing it on campus, but there's also an underlying cultural problem about sexual harassment, sexual assault, that is a separate issue. I do think it's important, though, for students to know that if they report a sexual assault, they will not be prosecuted by their schools for underage drinking, because that is something that is going to keep a lot of students from reporting.
Jane McQueenie, what are your thoughts about that as it pertains to the KU campus?
Well, first of all, we do have an amnesty policy that really says we're more concerned about the welfare of the student, and so we aren't going to prosecute if there's been underage drinking. I do think that there are separate issues. They tend to, the drinking does play out in the investigative part of it. And I like the affirmative yes plus yes. I still think no means no, but it's really stressing to our students also that silence isn't consent. And I think it's in the dialogue. I've been really encouraged by Emma and some of the other students on campus in terms of the dialogue we're having, the engagement with our students. These are complex issues. And I'm very encouraged to see that the students care and they're willing to learn and listen and have felt so passionately about these issues.
Jane, what about the relationship between the Greek system and the school? The one fraternity was recently put on probation, but both the incident that is being discussed this week with this probationary action and the incident from 2013 occurred at fraternities or involved fraternities. Can you talk a little bit about how the school relates to these institutions?
That's a good question. And so really what Title IX did was say, even if it happens off campus, and I think in the past schools would say, hey, you know what, fraternities, sororities, they're off campus. It's not our issue. But what Title IX and the guidance from OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, said is even if it happens off campus, if the result of that conduct comes back onto campus, schools have to do something. They have to ensure access to education.
Laura Ziegler, KCUR reporter, jump in here.
I just want to say one thing that in the context of the federal report that came out, sexual violence on campuses, one of the things they looked at was this relationship between sororities and fraternities. Two-thirds of the schools that they looked at don't penalize fraternities and sororities or have any policy that involves fraternities and sororities. So it is a huge problem, that relationship across the country.
At KU, we're doing something, though. So maybe not in a lot of other schools.
Maybe we'll have some callers weigh in on that, too. But for now, I do want to turn to Kristen, who tweeted us, parents need to have conversations with kids before they go to college about what is consent. Give them tools and words. Emma, I wonder if you can respond to that. What do you think is possible at a university once 18-year-olds have already shown up? Do you think that people are already coming with their baggage related to these topics? They've already sort of formed their ideas, maybe.
It's hit and miss. So we have students who come from a huge range of backgrounds, from people who have had parents who are willing to engage in these conversations with them, who have had excellent sex education in high school. And then we have students who grew up in a more conservative community where these issues weren't talked about. They weren't given the language that they would need to talk effectively about sexual consent, anything like that. And so what happens in your first year of college is you take all of these students and you add a high-pressure environment, you add alcohol, you add parties, you add social pressures, and you stir. And often the result that comes out is ugly and traumatic for a lot of students. So I think the university has a really unique opportunity to engage with these students as soon as they get here or even before they get here to make sure that everyone has an established baseline for what acceptable behavior is and for effective ways that students can intervene when they see other bad things happening to other students.
We're going to take another short break. You've still got time to participate in this discussion. Do you have questions about how sexual assault cases are handled on college campuses? We have people who can answer those questions. Call 816-235-2888. Central Standard will be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with KCUR reporter Laura Ziegler, who's been reporting on sexual assault policies at local college campuses. We're also joined by KU student Emma Holling, KU's Title IX coordinator Jane McQueenie, and Lara Kaufman. She's senior counsel and director of educational policy for at-risk students. These are the people who are going to be responding to our many callers, so I'll go ahead and turn to them to hear what they're interested in knowing about sexual assault on college campuses. Let's turn to Jesse in Kansas City. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I'm an advocate with MOXA, which is a local nonprofit serving survivors of sexual assault and abuse in the greater Kansas City area. And early in the show, you had mentioned the importance of having an option for students to be able to disclose the assault confidentially. So I wanted to add that victim advocacy organizations like MOXA can be a really important resource for survivors of sexual assault on campus. Certainly, campus support is essential, but community victim advocacy organizations can offer an option for support from outside the campus system or criminal justice system, which can be really valuable to survivors to make sure they have access to both free and confidential services, but also that they have those supports regardless of whether or not they prefer to participate in the criminal justice process or report the assault.
Hey, Jesse, what kind of work do you all do to make sure that people on college campuses know that you are a resource that's available to them, that what the campus offers isn't all that there is for them?
Sure. Well, MOX in particular does a lot of community outreach, and I know various community advocacy programs do similar things to make connections and build relationships with area universities so that they know that we can be a resource to students, but that we can also reach students directly through campus activities and events that we may be participating in, and certainly just ongoing education activities. Sometimes, for instance, we'll get invited to do a presentation in a classroom or attend a student fair where we can have a table and distribute materials.
Well, thanks so much, Jesse.
Thank you.
And Jane McQueenie, do you in the as a Title IX coordinator at KU tell students who bring reports to you about resources available to them beyond the university system?
Absolutely. Every conversation we have with the complainant at that very first meeting, we talk about resources. So we have counseling and psychological services, or CAPS, on our campus, and they are confidential reporters. We have Gadugi, the Rape Counseling and Safe Center in Lawrence, and we refer many of our students to those resources. Our Emily Taylor Center for Women and Gender Equity, I mentioned them earlier. So we're having those conversations early, and MOX is also an additional great resource for our students.
Let's hear from Francis in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Francis.
Hey, I know that Lawrence Police Department has a policy of non-involvement in domestic issues. And I'm wondering how this is not just a domestic issue framed with college people. I mean, what's the difference between a domestic issue that occurs between two people in Lawrence that are not students and a domestic issue that occurs between two people in Lawrence that are students, and why are they treating that differently?
Let's tease out a couple of things here. First of all, he's saying that Lawrence has a specific kind of policy, that the police has a specific policy relating to domestic violence. Do you know if that's accurate?
I can't really respond to that. I would find it surprising that the Lawrence police wouldn't respond to issues of domestic violence or domestic abuse. I can say that under Title IX and the Campus Save Act, domestic violence and dating violence are things that we are going to take into consideration under our auspices of Title IX coordinator.
And Lara, could you maybe weigh in for us on this question of, first of all, if these students particularly are of age, they're 18 or older, they're considered adults, how is it that things that occur off campus with them are understood maybe differently than things that occur just out in the general population?
Well, it needs to be taken just as seriously as an incident that would occur in the general population. I think when a victim reports an incident to a university, the university has an obligation under the law to let her know what her rights are, that she has the right to go to the police if she chooses to pursue the criminal justice process. If the police are choosing for some reason not to take that seriously, not to conduct an investigation, that's a problem. But in terms of the obligation of the school, it's merely to inform students that that is an option. And under some new regulations that Jane was referring to, it's very clear that in counting and reporting campus crime statistics, that schools need to also report on incidents of domestic violence and dating violence, which are forms of sexual violence.
So is something that happens in, say, a fraternity house a domestic violence situation or not?
No, I don't think so. First of all, it could be a stranger rape situation. We have no idea. It's going to depend on the circumstances of each case. But even if the people know each other, we call that acquaintance rape. If they're dating, we call that date rape or dating violence. So I don't think the status of the individuals should determine whether or not it's considered a crime. It may still be a crime, although, of course, the consideration, the relationship can be considered in the investigation in terms of whether or not there was consent.
Let's talk now to, and thank you to that caller, Francis. Let's turn now to Andrea in Kansas City. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm a graduate student and a teaching assistant at KU. And so I instruct, a couple of classes out there every semester. And one thing that's frustrating from the teaching standpoint is that a lot of us really try to emphasize women's rights and women's issues and to have discussions with students about this and the implications for their real, for their life outside of school or outside of the classroom. But then when they see that college institutions, and not just KU, but that there's this nationwide epidemic of sexual assault and that the institutions don't always seem to take the accusations as seriously or that they don't follow through with really strict punishments. It might be confusing for students who hear in the classroom or from, student advocates that these are really important issues, but then when they see the university system not really take it as seriously, it's frustrating. And it might, give them this mindset that even if what they're doing might be questionable, that maybe they'll get away with it.
Let's hear from the student who's sitting right here in the room about this, because Emma, you're nodding right now.
Yeah, there is a certain amount of cognitive dissonance that happens when at KU, we had, as our first valedictorian back in the 1800s, a woman, which was exceptional and spectacular. And for women students to come here and you know, be told by certain instructors that women's rights are important and things like that. But then to see either ourselves or our friends suffering and not getting what we feel is effective recourse, there is a cognitive dissonance that happens there, and you wonder whether or not you can fully trust the university.
Jane, how do you respond to that?
Well, I want to say that, you know, I take all of these cases, we take all of these cases very seriously. And in last year, we had 12 cases that we characterized as sexual violence, and six of those cases resulted in expulsions or suspensions. One, we recommended non-admission. Three cases were probation, and two were insufficient evidence. So I think that part of what we need to do is make sure students understand that we are taking these cases seriously, and we do take them seriously.
I want to talk about some of the specific student criticisms that have come out of this. There's been a petition that has 10 specific requests, and one of those requests is that the minimum punishment for sexual assault and harassment exceed the punishment for plagiarism. Is that currently not the case?
Well, I think that again is an issue that we need to do some education for our students. I think that at our forum with the chancellor and the provost indicated that out of 400 cases of plagiarism, there had only been two expulsions. So clearly our rate of expulsion on sexual assault cases is much greater. You have a 100% chance of greater chance of getting expelled if you're...
But they're talking about the minimum response.
And I think, again, that the policy on plagiarism has a range of punishments. It's discretionary with the instructor, and so there can be an admonishment. So, again, I think there's a whole range of punishments similar to what's in our student code for sexual harassment, sexual violence violations.
There's also been a recommendation that there be a victim's advocate installed within the university's judicial process. And Lara, I wonder, is that something that is commonly part of the process of investigating and punishing incidents of sexual assault on campus, or is the victim's advocate and the victim's psychological recovery and all of those things, is that treated typically as separate?
Typically, it's treated as separate. And I think there are some institutions that have started in this direction, but typically it's treated as separate. And in some schools, they don't allow students to have anybody with them at the hearing. That's going to change. They're supposed to be allowed to have somebody with them at the hearing. But it can be a tremendously intimidating, alienating process for a victim to go through an investigation and a hearing. So it's important that she feels supported. And we're not talking about a lawyer necessarily, but we're talking about someone who's looking out for her rights and her needs.
The petition also calls for a revision of policies by a committee made up of at least 51% students with final approval by the Student Senate. How much power should students have in shaping these policies? And Lara, I want to start with you on that.
Well, I think it's important to have student input on policies. I think it's very important that when disciplinary decisions are being made, that students not be involved in that process. Because I think at some schools, that is what's going on. There are student boards conducting hearings, which is really inappropriate in sexual assault cases. But in terms of student empowerment and feeling like they've been heard and they're part of the process of developing school policies, I think that's a good development. And you know, the National Women's Law Center sees the student advocacy around these issues to be a really positive development.
Emma, as a student, if you could see just one change come out of this whole process and this whole ordeal, what would you focus on?
We need to make it easier for the victims to go through this process. I think that will resolve a number of the issues, and the way to do that is by installing a victim's advocate who can help a victim through the process, through that difficult two-part process, and who can really be on their side. So a lot of times what will happen, if there are accusations made, the student who is accused will get a lawyer. His family will pay for it. He'll bring one. He'll bring it into the cases. And sometimes the victim doesn't even want her family to know that this has happened for a number of reasons. And so she is in these hearings alone. And to have one student with an administrator representing her case up against someone who has a lawyer is a big power imbalance, and it leaves people feeling very unhappy at the end of the process. So I think having an advocate there who is on that victim's team, who's not necessarily a lawyer, but who knows the process, who knows what it's going to look like, who can warn the student what's going to happen, who knows what a good probationary ask is, right? So, like, we allow victims to make recommendations about what they think should happen to the perpetrator, but if a student's never been through this process before, they may not know what an adequate suggestion would be.
Wow. Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation. Emma Halling, former KU student body president and co-chair of KU's Title IX committee, thank you so much for voicing students' concerns this morning.
Thank you.
And Jane McQueeney, Title IX coordinator for KU, thank you for responding to those concerns.
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to talk about this topic.
Lara Kaufman of Education Policy for At-Risk Students, your insights have been so helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Laura Ziegler, I always appreciate your reporting. Looking forward to hearing what else you dig up.
Oh, thanks, Gina.
Tomorrow, we'll meet the Lawrence musician behind the band that has spawned a genre known as wizard rock. That band is Harry and the Potters. More on that tomorrow morning at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. The audio of KU Chancellor Bernadette Gray Little was gathered by Stephen Caranda of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's a wrap. Stick around for Up to Date next.